Liquid nitrogen and liquid oxygen have been around a long time. There's a hell of a lot of know-how in handling. I think that handling liquid hydrogen wasn't all that tough, but there was a great deal of fear of explosions and other things, as I said. I think people sucked out against it, and they found it much easier to use.
When did they? Well, when did you begin to make that psychological turnaround? Was that?
Well, I guess when we started actually using it, we went through a hell of a lot of precautions, and we found that they were useful. But although hydrogen has a wide explosive limit, it's also light and diffuses light real rapidly, so that it's hard. It's not too easy to get a hydrogen. And some of the fires that we did have or explosions were not too great in severity.
You did have some, though.
Yeah, for example, if you vent hydrogen through a pipe, as we did, say you want to depressurize a tank, and you just open the valve and vent it to the atmosphere, chances are excellent that it'll self-collect. You'll get an ignition and a boom from it. We did it several times. It was pretty light. The reason for the ignition is a number of possibilities. One is just static a static discharge.
Mm-hmm. You also bent the hell out of the pipe.
Yeah. Yeah. I remember, you see this facility, this was built
not easy for me to really understand, I guess, the relationship of a place like Lewis to industry. The fact, you know, that they can all come in and get this information out. I guess what I'm getting at is, where does a lot of this stuff really begin? And maybe it's hard to say who really comes up with the idea, because there is such a mixing at this point within a center.
Well, part of the answer to what's bothering you could go back to the reason why NACA was established in 1915, and it was established by the government to study the problems of flight with a view towards a practical solution. That was
right,
the charter.
Yeah.
But at the bottom, one of the basic reasons was that a lot of this research required facilities that were so expensive that they were beyond the reach of any individual company, and therefore the government as a whole would build these enormous wind tunnels and millions of dollars worth of facilities, and do fundamental work in aerodynamics and propulsion and so forth, make it available to U.S. industry in general, and benefit them all. And this, in other words, a government laboratory exists for the benefit of all the people.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore, our information is public property, and we do it for not for an individual group or a special group, but for the benefit of all. And that's why also, NACA did not have big contracts with industry, as does NASA.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't develop any. We were more purely more on research. The primary contract work was with universities. So we were not, and these labs, we were not in competition with them. We were corollary or complementary to their needs.
Mm-hmm.
For that reason, they came to hear our information. We had research conferences. An old tradition, right? There's a picture of a research conference of NACA in 1933, and about all the big names in aeronautics that were gathered in that picture in 1933 to hear the latest results of aeronautical research during that time period. And this kind of tradition involved in the work. Now, when we got into the business, as I mentioned in this paper, we got in through the back door. First of all, there were pretty high-level management in NACA that didn't think we should be in rocket motors. So we were named the high-pressure combustion section. And we found, as Johnny come lately, that we were way behind JPL and others in many of the aspects. They were the big wheels in the rocket. So we tried to choose a field that wasn't so well plowed, and also one that was fairly close to our other capabilities and propulsion and so on. And so that brought us quickly to liquid propulsion.
Mm-hmm.
And then we decided to try to jump over. Everyone was working on things like, not everyone, but there was a lot of attention on alcohol and oxygen and things for missiles for the military, acid and gas. We decided we would try to go leapfrog that and go into real high energy propellants. And that's why we got interested in diborane and ammonia as fuels, and hydrogen as fuels, and chlorine as an oxidizer, and ozone, and liquid oxygen mixtures of these things. And we were pretty much, our work was, we did probably more work in this at that time than anyone else. We weren't the first, though, in any of these. For example, North American and a man named Doyle did work on chlorine and gaseous chlorine and hydrogen before we did it.
Mm-hmm.
And Bell Aircraft was not too far behind us. They were some. The Air Force got interested in work we were doing and sponsored the work as well.
I recall you got some of your supplies from Air Force plants, hydrogen, for example.
Yeah, now that's a good story and one that I don't know too much about and want to trace down. The Air Force got real hot on hydrogen for high altitude bombers. And I think that's the reason they built the Air Force plant. They had Johnston working with it. Also, some of the equipment we got surplus from the Air Force that was Johnston design was connected with the atom bomb. We didn't know a damn thing about that except that here was the equipment.
He was involved with the Manhattan Project.
There must have been.
Yeah.
I think that's where he got his biggest support, but I don't know.
I've already posed yes, but there is. One question that comes to mind, and appreciate your comment on, if you have time to speak. That is, one of the arguments against the Earth Orbital Rendezvous was the in-flight refueling of liquid hydrogen. Do you feel that could have been safely done, or do you think that would have comprised a very high-risk effort?
I think at that time we would have considered a fairly high-risk effort. We still haven't done that.
What about now? Do you think it could be?
I don't think it's too tough a problem, although we're proposing for fiscal 73 an experiment to find out. And that means we have a way to go.
Do you feel that we could have made it to the moon had we opted for the EOR approach rather than the LOR.
I think we could have. I think we could have gotten it either way. Are you familiar with this? Have you seen this? It's marked confidential. This has been classified. I can get this.
I don't know. John's been working more in the early areas here.
This was one of the here's another one. Also classified. NASA's long-range plans to the President's Science Advisory Committee in October 60. These were some of the presentations and considerations that led to the Saturn development. George Lowe was on my committee for this. And Court Canright. Now there's a man you should talk to, Richard Canright. Have you run across him?
He's out of Douglas.
Yeah.
Yeah, he's retired by the time we got out there.
You tried to locate him. I think
he was
doing that.
Canright was at ARC at the time, and Canright was familiar with our work from being on our subcommittee, and I think he was one of the prime movers in Saturn, in starting Saturn, the first stage of Saturn, but not necessarily Saturn.
Just going to ask you, again, from your work in liquid hydrogen, do you see any major differences?
I'd have to get that. Yeah, that's my
any major differences between the RL-10 and the J-2 engines, each having a kind of distinct personality, or are they really, I realize the, fuel feed systems are somewhat different and so on. Are they really two terribly distinct propulsion systems, or?
Well, I think the RL-10 was, definitely influenced the J-2, there's no doubt in my mind of that, and that, people who did the RL-10, J-2, had a certain amount of access to the information they were. Just how much, I don't know, you'd have to ask them, but there was a hell of a lot of exchange of information, even though company proprietary rights jealously guarded, speaking of company to company.
Yeah, that's interesting. They did share a lot of information, apparently, on kind of a friendly basis.
They were
engaged in a national program of sorts, and they all felt a commonality of goal. Then.
Yeah.
Would it be possible to borrow these two items? Say we have a copy in.
Was a very interesting type character. He, I remember one of his graduate students named White. Johnston would work the tail off of his graduate students, and they would carry, say, 95% of the work in the initiative, and at the final dissertation or paper, who was the senior author? A.J.L. Johnston.
This is the name of the game, right?
Name of the game.
But incidentally, do you recall any of his graduate students by name who subsequently went into Rocketdyne or to ABMA or?
Well, White's name I recall, but I don't know where he went after that. Lauren Bollinger, was shot to death by a robber. He went at Ohio State. He was in Columbus, set up a little consulting firm, and saw me a week before he was shot. He was still in the rocket field and consulting and construction and so forth. This happened about 3 or 4 years ago.
Could you
he
make
was accosted at night on the stairway in Columbus.
Could you make a statement about the work at Ohio State in kind of a historical context, some way comparing it to JPL and Aerojet and work at Lewis?
Well, of the three, I would rate them this way. I believe that that the Aerojet work was by far the heaviest, most heavily financed, and therefore the biggest effort. There were more people, more horsepower put on the job at Aerojet.
Yeah.
The work at JPL was very small, and the work at Ohio State was comparatively very small. the Ohio State work was done more as an adjunct to educational purposes, I believe, than it was industrial development. But they had a bona fide rocket lab. I visited there and saw it, and they had some unique types of equipment. It seems to me that they were one of the first to use strain gauges to weigh tanks as a means of determining the propellant flow. And if I recall, they also used, I think they used a flexure plate to do it. And we used that idea for measuring thrust. I think we swiped it from, I can't recall who did it first. But a lot of people use ball bearing parallelogram type of thrust structure.
Yeah.
It was ball bearings here and here and here, and this was a thing. This is fixed, and this can move, see, back and forth.
Yeah.
And they use that to measure thrust. It seems to me that I recall that Ohio State used a flexure plate to weigh their tanks, and that we adopted that idea to replace ball bearings for thrust stands. But that was one of their unique instrumentation techniques. And there's a fairly good literature on this. I don't think you'd have much trouble tracking it down. And if you get that report that I referenced here,
Johnson, yeah.
That's number 7. I'm sure it'll lead you to the others. He was if you look up the word Johnson in chemical abstracts, you're going to find about 150 or 200 references, because he was a prolific man. He had a lot of good graduate students. And you're going to find this to be quite large.
Well,
I may be crossing your path on that, because I'm intending to go enlarge this a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
And if there's anything I run across, I'd be happy to give you. And if you learn more, I'd like to acknowledge it. I did a little bit of, very little bit of his. I kept some notes of this, and I've got them somewhere. I'm going to look them up. I wrote a paper on hydrogen in 1963. And I don't know if I referenced it or not. But in there, I did look up the notes, and that's where I wrote about the Ohio State. So this time I went back to try to find sources. But you'll find, I think, quite a good literature built up